okay, you should get physical excitations.
Right. Okay.
And okay, to the extent that you can study this in first quantile formulation, okay, either by using the Rinomanson group or by first quantile theory. Okay, there you explicitly see the excitations around that.
Right.
But when you use string field theory, yeah, at least in the conventional sense, it has not been done.
I guess, although some mistakes have been made in string field theory.
Well, we found the solution, but we didn't study excitations around the solution.
Yeah.
Right? I think that's your question.
That's
part of the content here. I mean, the fact that this describes the solitons describe defense means that the excitations around the solitons will be described by open strings with another
data. There have been also papers by you that were calculating numerical excitation.
That's around the true vacuum, not where there are solitons. So there you don't expect to see any.
Okay. But in the BSFT picture, you can answer this question easily and analytically. And you can easily find the excitations around the lower dimension.
You put in this perturbation of the tachyon, and presumably you see that the ends end up wanting to be fixed at this the lower dimensional range.
The problem in the BSFT formulation is that you don't see very massive states, right? You don't know how to deal with the high dimensional operators.
Getting back to the question of finding the closed strings, I mean, is it possible that we would see the closed strings perturbatively after doing some field redefinition? I mean, if this basic string, open string field is A, and we define a new string field like A squared or something, taking on the idea that it should be some bounds there, could it be up here?
See, even that looks unlikely, because the 1 over G squared is in front of the action, right? So you can do field redefinition involving A, but you'll still get 1 over G open square times some action in terms of the new fields.
I guess another thing you might say is that the A carries Chan Patton factors if you put more than one brain in, and then you would not expect the open strings to carry Chan Patton factors.
But okay, that you can say you may get trace of A
square.
You can get some Chan Patton factor. But I think getting the right coupling is very difficult if you just try to do an only left field definition.
Absorb the factor of A. I mean, if we closed string coupling is the same as weak open string coupling, so it's not like we were trying to get something.
No, so weak closed string coupling is where of the weak open string coupling.
Right.
So when you try to do loop expansion.
What about just factoring out a factor 1 over open string coupling from there or something? I mean, it doesn't sound like such a bad problem just to get another factor in front of everything.
Yes, but I think what this shows is that it's probably not, it will not come just as by a classical field definition. The relationship between the open and closed strings is probably not purely classical.
Fatawa theory sounds very difficult to get closed string apart, because Fatawa theory Fatawa string start with a system of closed string and open string and go to the certain configuration of open string. And then forget about closed string that was there, Fatawa theory, and we want to get the closed string back in some other way.
No, see, the point is, if you use open string field theory, right, then the closed strings are there in the loop expansion. In particular, let's take this open string field theory, take these D-based solitons, and calculate the one loop effective potential using just the open string field theory.
Yeah, but stated in another way, my question was that, do you expect the open string theory by itself is consistent quantum theory in this, around this pattern?
At least it looks like that, it is a consistent quantum field theory. Right? It has closed string poles. But those you have to reinterpret this as some kind of bound states of open strings.
So it's really a theory of quantum gravity, right? We have a fluctuating measure. Even though, but you couple to the closed thing, there are closed thing background fields in general.
Yeah, but okay, imagine that you're starting with just flat 26 dimensional theory.
Okay.
And you have this open string field theory, which has these two solitons, which describe two D-brains. Now you calculate the one loop effective potential.
Yes.
Of that background, just using open string field theory. And that one loop effective potential will contain the closed string exchange interaction between these two theories. Right? So in that sense, the closed strings are contained in the open string field theory.
Yeah, my question was that in the porous vacuum, the original background, you have to have both closed string field and open string field in order to have a consistent perturbative expansion.
No, I don't think that's necessary. You don't need closed string fields. If I just have open string fields, that will give a perfectly sensible perturbative expansion.
Is that still true of the superstring? Are you absolutely sure of that?
In the case of superstring?
Yeah, because there is a...
Yeah, well, see, for superstring, of course, there are these contact and divergences and so on in the Wheaton's formulation, okay? And then there is an alternative perturbative formulation. But I don't think the perturbation theory has been studied there very well.
So it's not completely clear that Perosi's point will apply.
Yeah, okay, but I agree. I mean, because one doesn't have the complete formulation of string field theory for the superstring. Okay? Right. But the fact that in the bosonic case, you can get the closed string poles without putting them in.
Well, that's kind of special, right? I mean, the generic, you know, you can change the Witten vertex and then you have, then the open string goes non-polynomial and you have to include closed strings.
Yeah, exactly.
Isn't that correct?
Yeah. But
okay, so this is sort of a very, very special point in the space of string theory.
I agree. So, yeah. But maybe this is, I mean, the fact that at this special point you can get the closed strings, right, means that there is at least one formulation where you can get the closed strings out using open string theory.
But it's not, in a sense, a unitary... aside from the tachyon.
Closed string.
But no, they're closed string poles and there's no field to describe them. Right.
So, I know, but it's not, I'm actually questioning the perturbation expansion really exists.
They're closed string poles, but there are no closed string states. I mean, there are no external closed string states in this theory.
Well, no one has constructed them.
Then how do you write?
There's no way to write an S matrix involving the scattering in open string field theory. No way to write down an S matrix involving the scattering of some number of open string quanta and some number of gravitons.
Well. Okay, but you can derive that by factorization,
but the fact that you can derive it by factorization and without having the open string states is to say that the original theory wasn't unitary, right? Because it omitted the states that appear as
right,
both.
In the intermediate channel.
Right.
I'm
agreeing with
you. Yeah, okay. Right, yeah.
But that would have an limit in QCD. You don't put in the protons and the ions as fields. Hmm.
Oh, of course not, but they...
But they appear as poles in the Higgs function.
Yeah. Would EV picture somehow these electric flux tubes would be closed strings and then upon quantization they would keep the graphite? It would be very hard about way, but somehow...
Yeah, so it's certainly not clear how the closed strings would have emerged, right? But certainly there is a lot of evidence that the closed strings are contained in this theory.
So the open strings are effectively strongly coupled at the minimum. Depending on how you scale
G string. Yeah, but again, that may depend on fields you are using. It's not clear that it is, there is a genuine strong coupling case it's going on at the minimum. Yes, if you use the effective field theory description, then it does look strongly coupled because the coefficient of the kinetic term is going to zero. Okay, but that may be just one choice of variables. Okay, and as we will try to argue, so that may not be the right choice of variables. That may not be the most convenient choice of variables for this problem. Okay. So let me then go ahead and ask how do you go about proving or even just finding evidence for these three conjectures. And there are various approaches. These are approaches based on the first quantized formulation. These are approaches based on more like second quantized formulation. And for my talk, I'll focus mostly on this approach, namely standard Qubit string field. Or some slight modification of standard Qubit string field. And the reason that I want to focus on this approach is, in some sense, this seems to be the most complicated. Because this doesn't suffer from the kind of problem that the background independent string field theory suffers from, namely that it's not well defined for operators of higher dimension. So once you start perturbing the operators of higher dimension, okay. Non-commutative solution, this can address the problem in spatial backgrounds and also only part of the problem. It can address the problem of finding the solitons, but not, for example, finding a vacuum. So string field theory can in principle address all of these conjectures, but it also is in some sense most difficult. But we will see how far you can go using this approach. But since superstring field theories are not as well understood as bosonic string field theory, we will study this in the simpler context of bosonic string theory. And the reason that one hopes that this is a good approach is because if you look at the classical properties of deep brains in bosonic string theory, and that's all you are studying at this stage, they are very similar to that of the brain antibrain system in superstring theory. And so the hope is that once you understand the classical dynamics of bosonic string theory, then we can use this insight to study the generalize this to the dynamics of brain antibrain system in the superstring theory. So let's see what we can get by studying this problem in bosonic string theory. But before I do that, I have to review the analog of this conjecture for bosonic string theory. So let me just briefly review what we think about deep brains in bosonic string theory. So unlike in the case of superstring theory, if you start with the bosonic string theory, it has DP brains for all P, but for all of these DP brains have a tachyonic mode. Okay, in fact, each of these DP brains has a single tachyonic mode, which means that it has a real scalar field with negative cos square. And you ask the same question, that is there a global minimum of the tachyon potential? In this case, we don't expect a global minimum because of the closed string tachyon, but at least one could ask for a local minimum. And there are very similar set of conjectures which try to answer this question. So the first conjecture says that the tachyon potential does have a local minimum, but a negative contribution from the potential exactly cancels the tension of the DP brain. Okay. So the relationship now is that V at the minimum, P naught, plus the tension of the DP brain is identically equal to 0. The second conjecture says that the local minimum, V naught, of the potential represents closed string vacuum without any DP brain, and that in turn means that again around this vacuum we are certain the open string excitations at all in this string field theory.
Could you describe what happens on the left hand part of that picture?
Well, it's not even clear whether, I mean, this part makes real sense, right? I mean, you would say that this part probably doesn't make sense, right, beyond a certain point.
Well, we have a couple of colleagues who assert otherwise.
I would have argued that at one point, but actually, from VSFTs, it seems to go all the way down to minus infinity. And the place where we found this branch point is actually the boundary of the region where the Heinemann-Siegel gauge is good. So I don't know that Q extreme field theory could actually say anything.
Yeah, it could be that this has something to do with the closed string tachyons, but I don't know. So, I mean, because we are using this closed string filter only for studying classical dynamics, it's sufficient if we just restrict to this part. We cannot do quantum filter with this closed string, with this part of the open string filter.
Well, operator, there are two tachyons, right? There's the open and the closed, and there are two directions, right?
No, the closed string tachyon will come at the open string loop level. Okay? So, at the classical open string theory, you will not see the closed string tachyon.
I thought you and Barton had some papers that talked about the metric in this direction and some possible subtleties with what looked like a finite direction and distance in T space being an infinite distance in the appropriate metric or something. Is that a different situation?
No, I don't think we had any.
There's a related singularity which they found in the context of doing a marginal deformation. There was some speculation that these singularities might have to do with going an infinite distance in field space,
but that can't get
rid of the singularities they found. Singularities they found are different, and neither one seems to have to do with an infinite distance in field space.
Okay. Right. But why would the closed string be relevant to this at all, since the open string field theory is? The closed string tachyon has no reason to appear if you perturb the tachyon this way, right?
Yeah. See, on a classical level, you can work around this point without worrying about this. You will start saying this only at the quantum level. And once you go to the quantum level, presumably the closed strings are important.
But if you start at the top for the local maximum, then you just have an open string tachyon, and the closed string tachyon might be some composite.
Yeah.
But the open string tachyon is the direction that you're seeing.
Exactly. So you can either roll down this way or this way. Okay. But suppose we consider this vacuum. Okay, and we study the theory around this point. This can be studied as a consistent classical theory without worrying too much about this.
What physically corresponds to starting to roll in the other direction?
That's what I'm asking, right?
It's the open string tachyon.
Yeah.
You do it quite with the open string. You start at the top of the hill. The claim is one direction corresponds to the D25, anti-D25 annihilating.
Yes.
Well, what does the other direction correspond to?
Right.
Yeah. It's not even clear at the classical level how to set it up as an initial value problem, because the field flow is non-local, right? So you don't even know what kind of initial condition you should specify before you can study this problem dynamically.
Well, the top of the potential is interpretive, and we're just given a little bit of a push.
Yeah, but
for the complex tachyon, you don't have this problem.
For the complex tachyon, any direction is gauge equivalent to any other direction. Here the claim is there are two gauge inequivalent directions.
In the moment of RG flow, does it know what the, is there a different relevant operator?
Or what's going on is the string coupling is getting very large. In the boundary string field theory, you have e to the minus t integrated around the boundary. So, if t is going to minus infinity, that means each boundary is contributing a lot. So we're going to have spontaneous herniation.
The company calls that the
contraction.
So some holes in the regal circles, right?
Yeah.
They're kind of extra dominant.
I think so, but I mean, there's so many confusions about doing it. Going to quantum perturbation theory and the boundary string field theory approach, I would insist on this, because you could then ask me about the integration over the moduli space. The moduli includes the length of the boundary.
Right.
Get into a quantum space.
I guess neglecting that reaction is bad as soon as you roll far enough down. So you have no excuse to run.
I'm very skeptical.
Okay, and the third conjecture is again very similar. It says that the theory contains classical lump solutions, which are not dimensional events. These are again unstable lump solutions, because the lower dimensional events are also unstable. So here what happens is, if P naught is the vacuum, then you can consider a solution where P have to test P naught on both ends, but it has the form of a lump around the origin, and this is supposed to describe P events of lower dimension. Depending on how many transverse directions you have, this P is a function of only one coordinate, and it's a P minus 1 then. If it's a function of two coordinates, it's P minus 2 then, and so on. So we'll try to study these conjectures using string field theory, and the reason that we need string field theory is simply because although we have been so far talking about tachyon potential and tachyon lump solution, if we really want to study the full dynamics of wavelengths, then we need to consider the theory of infinite number of coupled wavelengths. Because the open string, there are infinite number of open strings on the wavelength, and we have to consider the coupled wavelengths.
Ashok, is this lump supposed to go beyond the maximum of the potential in the solution or to the maximum?
No, it doesn't go all the way to the maximum.
You mean, but in your coordinates, t equals 0 was not the maximum?
Yeah, it's supposed to be, it goes beyond the maximum. Though.
Exactly.
It probes some of these things.
From
That's a solution.
So t certainly goes beyond 0. Okay? Here's that's part of the instability of this lump. Okay, we know that this lump is not stable. Okay, and the reason that it's not stable is has something to do with the fact that it goes beyond the maximum.
Right, would have been unstable even if it just went to the maximum and came back.
But they have actual instability, right?
Oh, it's because you want two
instability. Because for the DP frame with P less than 25, yeah. Should also have two directions where
that's a good reason.
Okay, so let me then give a brief preview of the standard strength field so that I describe the different dynamics. Okay, and here, as I have said, I'll use Wittgenstein's version of strength field theory. For a strength field phi is a state of host number 1 in the Hilbert space of matter host for small field theory that describes first quantile open strength field. So this simply is taken as a definition of what the strength field is. And if you want to see the fields or the specific components of the fields, you can simply choose the basis of states in the Hilbert space, which are denoted by phi 1 r, 1 stands for host number. And the coefficients of expansion in this basis are simply the dynamical variables of strength field. So given a strength field configuration means that we are given a set of values of the variable psi r. Now this sum over r includes sum over oscillator indices, which is a discrete index, but also integration about the momentum. Because when you look at the full basis of states, this contains both oscillator levels as well as the momentum levels. And that's the reason why these are fields. Because this contains, these are actually functions of the momentum, which are the Fourier transform versions of functions of states. And given a string field configuration, we can write down the action which has this form. So the first term in the action is quadratic. So this denotes the VPZ inner product. Q means just the BRST charge. And star is the standard star product. I'll define it now. I'll define it later when I need it. But for the time being, it's just sufficient to note that this star product, what this does is that it simply takes two states in H and maps it into third state in H. And those numbers add. Okay, so if A and B have host number 1 each, then A star B has host number 2. So this then completely defines what the strength field theory is, what the action of the strength field theory is, and what the variables of strength field theory is. And so now the idea is that we simply want to look for the classical solutions of the equation that we get by varying this action. Now this theory also has a set of gauge invariants which take this form. The lambda here is an arbitrary state of host number 0 in this theory. And again, if you want to see this, so this is the gauge transformation parameter. And if you want to see the parameters as numbers, you simply expand lambda in the basis of host number 0 states. And the coefficients of expansion are simply the gauge transformation parameters. So what one can show is that the action that I wrote down in the previous transparency, which is here, this action is invariant under a gauge transformation of this kind, where lambda is an arbitrary state of host number 0. And I'll not give both the proof of the gauge invariance, but I'll state the identities that are required in order to prove the gauge invariance. And these identities can be shown to hold for the standard BRST charge and standard star product definition of Wittgenstein's theory. So first of all, we need the nilpotence of the BRST charge. QB square should vanish. Then QB should distribute over the star product, okay, which means that QB or A star B can be written as a sum of two terms, QB A star B and A star QB B. And there is a sign factor here where NA is simply the host number of A. This takes into account the sign that comes in moving QB through A. And finally, there is a harmonicity condition on QB, which says that QBA and B, VPZ inner product, is related to the VPZ inner product of A with QB. So these three identities involve QB, and then there are other three identities that one needs, which do not involve QB, but just the inner product and the star product, which says that these identities hold. In particular, this says that Tartar rank is associated.
Large gauge transformations that
deserve
this action?
Yeah. See, in principle, of course, there should be large gauge transformations, but I mean, at least in this formulation, it's hard to guess that, because we only know how to define in principle gauge transformations. So, if you want to describe large gauge transformations, you have to write it in terms of e to the lambda. And where this exponentiation has to be done, the product is the star product. Okay. So, formally, you can write a large gauge transformation that way.
Related question. Is there any evidence that we should make like discrete identifications on the string field? Or is the string field space literally
gauge transformations will make?
Well,
yeah. At least, I mean, none that one knows.
You wouldn't really like ordinary transignments here?
No, I'm thinking of something related to discussions we've had with Wadi. We're asking ourselves if one should be identifying string fields.
Which differ by large.
Which differ by discrete amounts.
Okay. Yeah, so at least, no. Yeah, I don't know of any.
Could ask this question, but can one define an unoriented bosonic string field theory so that you require the fields to be symmetric under the reflection of the
Yeah, that I think you can do, because you can take the string field theory and model by omega, for example.
Is the U one gauge?
Right, and that will be unoriented.
So it just means that the value of the string field in the opposite orientations is constrained.
Exactly.
Fine.
That's right. Okay. So now, suppose, so we start with the D25 pen. Although it's not necessary. And suppose we denote by phi naught the classical solution that represents the tachyon fluctuation. So which means that it satisfies the usual straight field equation for motion, which is given here. Now given this, if we want to define the straight field to reaction around phi naught, what we'll do is to we'll define a shifted field psi, which is phi minus phi naught, and expand the action around in terms of psi. So the first term, of course, is a constant term, which is the value of s at phi naught. And then we have two terms again, a quadratic term and a cubic term. And it's clear that since the full action was cubic, if we make a shift like this, the cubic term is not going to change. The cubic term will remain the same, but the quadratic term will change. In general, it has the form psi q psi, where q is a different operator. I have written down the form of q here. Q acting on any state is defined to be this. And you can easily check that when you substitute this form of Q, you get back the action expanded force of psi. So it simply says that the quadratic term gets shifted by from QB to Q. And one can show that as long as phi naught satisfies the equations of motion, Q satisfies the set of identities which are very similar to the set of identities that QB satisfied. So let me show you that QB, there is an exact one-to-one correspondence between the identities that QB satisfies. So first of all, QB was nilpotent, QB distributed over A star B, and QB had this hermeticity property. Q has exactly the same properties. And since these properties guarantee daily invariance, as I said, we can easily check that the new action A tilde of psi, which are defined here, is gauge invariant as well. And the new gauge transformation laws of psi take this form, with Q being replaced by Q. And this, of course, is not surprising, because if you started with a gauge invariant action and if you shifted field, you will get a gauge invariant action. And, okay, so I'll describe this set of three identities together with E, because this set of identities will become important later. So in terms of this formulation, we can now restate what the various conjectures state. So the first conjecture says that the value of the action at phi naught, which is nothing but a negative of the potential energy, should be equal to the volume of space 10 times the d25 gradient. Because this is the total potential energy of the original d25 gradient. The third conjecture says that the inclusions of motion will not only have this constant solution, but it should have also co-dimensional 25 minus p lambda solutions, which are denoted by phi p. And these lambda solutions have the property that the value of the action for phi p minus the value of the action for the vacuum solution should be equal to minus the volume of p plus one dimensional space time times the dp tangent. This is simply a statement that these lambda solutions should have energy equal to the tension of the dp plane times the volume. The minus sign comes simply because the action is related to the potential energy by the minus sign. And the second conjecture will say that this operator Q should have vanishing cohomology. Okay, because Q is the coordinate term around the vacuum.
Excuse me, just I ask the same question around, but do you really have some evidence that Q cannot have cohomology equivalent to the cohomology of the closed string VRST operator Q, so that Q would just count the physical closed string excitations around the minimum?
Yeah, see, if it did happen, then again we will have the same problem of getting the correct coupling. Okay? Suppose the cohomology of Q was the usual VRST cohomology of closed strings. That would mean that the closed strings are solutions of linearized fluctuations of this classical field theory. Okay? Closed string states should be described as solutions of linearized fluctuations. And then when you look at the interaction between these closed strings, you will find that they interact with open string coupling strength rather than the closed string coupling strength.
You just redefine the field by the square root of Gs, Gary.
But see, you cannot change coupling by redefining fields, eh?
It's a relative problem.
Yeah, maybe the first order in G cancels by the higher order term in G, that it's just Gs.
Okay.
Well, okay, so these are to be somehow non interacting closed strings. Right, at the tree level, and then somehow the one loop corrections and open strings will become the real actual coupling between two strings. Yeah, that is possible.
Well, wait, but you get some effective contribution to the coupling from the valve of whatever you started with, right? I mean, you have, there's another parameter of the coupling, which is this difference of fields, right?
Yeah, but that doesn't depend on G, because one over G squared can be factored out completely.
But in the second problem, again, I'm just asking the same question again, because we're still working with the original fields, and they're action looks like it goes field becomes strongly coupled as you go through the minimum because of the V of T out front, right?
Well, see, I mean, the point is that V of T in front is not a universal phenomenon. I mean, it depends on what particular description you are using. Mm-hmm. And as you will try to argue the idea that that's not necessary. Mm-hmm. See, I mean, the question is whether this Q varies or not, right? Q is a the quadratic term. If there is really a V of T in the front, then Q will be zero. Yeah, we are not saying that Q is zero. Yeah, in fact, we will, I mean, reformulate the theory by Q is perfectly finite. Okay. Now, I should just state here that all these conjectures have been tested numerically using level truncation scheme. Okay, and I think Vati had already given a talk at the conference, so I'll not elaborate much on this. Okay, but I'll just say what the basic idea is. So the basic idea in the level truncation is that you start with a string field which has a linear combination of infinite number of states, okay? Because sum over R ranks over all states in the inverse space. But what you can do is that in this sum, you can restrict the expansion to those phi over R for which the level, okay, and the level here is defined as the maximal weight of phi over R plus 1. Okay? This plus 1 is simply to make the tachyon level 0. So we consider only those in this sum, so we restrict the sum to only over those states for which the total level is less than some number L. And if we keep L finite, then we have a finite number of things. Because below a given level, we have finite number of things. And so now we can simply think of this as a regular field theory, try to solve the equations of motion, or if it is your finite number of fields, either exactly or numerically, and then try to compute a homology numerically. So you can do everything numerically and you can see whether the results agree with the expected results. And the results do agree. Here are a list of references for various results. So you can verify, at least there is numerical evidence for all three convex jets by using this method. If you do see that the action, then you get the correct value of the vacuum energy, you do reproduce the solid terms, and you do see numerically that the homology vanishes.
Why does it work?
Why does it work?
There is no small parameter.
So it's not clear why level transition works. That's, it's not guaranteed that you have what, but it seems to work. Okay, so while this level transition is a good approach for numerical studies, getting analytical results seems to be very difficult in this approach. So what I'll describe now is to use an analytic approach to this problem and try to see how much you can get, how much get analytically using an indirect approach. So if we are trying to formulate string filter around the new vacuum, then the question that we need to address first is what is really the form of this kinetic term, because the cubic interaction is just a regular start product. The cubic term doesn't change under a scale. So the real question is, what is the form of Q? And this of course is not possible to find directly unless you know what the solution is. And this at present is not only numerical. So the approach that we'll follow is to see if we can guess the form of Q without actually solving for phi naught. So what information do we put in order to guess the form of Q? So here I have listed the requirements on Q. The first requirement is that Q must satisfy the gauge invariance constraints, which means that is identities. So if Q had come from a solution of the equations of motion, then of course these identities will be automatically satisfied. But in this case, we are trying to guess Q, so we do not have the, I mean, this equation to prove these identities. We have to make sure that the Q we choose satisfies this identity. The second condition is that Q must have vanishing cohomology, because this would imply absence of physical open string states, and hence we implement the second
condition. So before you go on, you know phi naught up to some level from the numerical work. Does that tell you what Q does acting on low level states?
Yeah, but that's what this does. And
so you know Q actually up to, you know, on some set of states.
But also to a field redefinition.
Yeah, up to a field redefinition. See, the point is okay. I mean, there are two ways of looking at it. That you can, you know Q, okay, once you have told, gotten the solution in a given gauge, you know Q. When you go to a different gauge, right, that corresponds to a field redefinition. So you cannot directly compare the Q that we are going to propose to the Q that you find by shifting fields. Because you can change your gauge and change your Q. But that change is simply a field redefinition of the final theorem. Okay, which preserves the start product.
But still, by considering possible gauge transformations and the low-level results, can't you check your conjecture for the form of the new Q?
Well, I think the fact that both have vanishing cohomology, right, is a strong indication that you can rotate one to the other.
Okay, but isn't there a stronger check than that?
It's not clear. At least, I mean, we did think about it, and it was not clear that there is a stronger check than one can think of.
It's kind of complicated.
But why would it be true that any two operators that have vanishing cohomology are related by a...
No, it's not true. I mean, it's a, yeah, so there is a lot more check to be, I mean, part of, right? So what we'll do is to start with this queue and see if we can reproduce all the convergences. Okay, in particular, we should go and reconstruct the full deep range solutions. Right? And that will be an non-trivial check that this is probably the right field.
If you are just looking at the cohomology, namely linearized equation motion, I would agree that any two cube which has trivial cohomology can be related in that way. But if you look for interactions, then clearly if you do arbitrary change of variables, the interaction would change.
Yeah, so the rotation should be such that which also preserve the starting point.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's not obvious that if two cohomology, there are two VRST operators which has bunching cohomology, both of them, that they can be mapped into each other in such a way that the field definition does not destroy the structure of the stuff.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, so the point is the fact that both of them distribute over the star product means that, I mean, already this says that even if they're related by rotation, they're not related by arbitrary rotation, because the Q that you get numerically and this Q, okay, both have the same distribution property of the start point. Mm-hmm. Right, whereas an arbitrary reinforcement will not have this property.
I think it's important to say that there are manifolds which are not homomorphic that have the same cohomology.
Yeah, so it's not a proof at all. Right? I'm not saying that there's a proof that this Q is the same as the Q that you get by the shift. So what we will do is we will simply try to take this as our, theory,
yeah,
and see whether you can reproduce all the other results about
coming back to Hiroshi's comment, so there is a restriction that you preserve the star product. That tells you that you only allow certain kinds of field redefinitions.
That's
and
it.
You guys write down
sometimes
these e to the k things.
Yeah. Well, see, e to the k is only a special class. That's not the only kind of
thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
See, any gauge transformation. Psi goes to psi star lambda minus lambda star psi, which preserves the star product, right? While lambda is an arbitrary state in the Hilbert space.
Yeah. Okay, so you could refine the question and ask whether, you know, if you think about the most general field redefinition that preserves the star product, whether you can actually, make comparison via such a field redefinition with the level truncation results. And you say that's still too hard.
It seems hard. I mean, another way of turning that around is to take the numerically determined Q and to try to do a field redefinition which puts it in their form and then to try to check whether it preserves the star product.
Okay.
And it's hard to, I mean, one could try harder, but if you're just doing low levels, you don't have very much accuracy, so you're not quite sure whether what you've got is working, and it's a big mess.
Not enough graduates.
If you'd like to.
The space of Qs, should I think of that as the space of conformal field theories from C equals 26?
No, because Q will be universal, I'm coming to that.
If I drop the constraint, then it has trivial cohomology. I'm trying to understand where we're working, really. Is the space of Qs to be thought of as the space of cohomology theory?
Yeah. Well, is the vacuum a cohomology theory?
It's consistent open the
you define Markov ring theory as just consistent open string background, yes. Space of Qs is the
more low gauge.
Yeah.
But you are also including the possibility that the ghosts are not decoupled, or do you?
Well, I haven't even generalized that. When I said C equals 26 conformal field theories, I even decoupled the ghosts. But you're quite right.
But in this background, we might as well be considering the case when the ghosts are not necessarily.
I agree.
Yeah.
So there's even a bigger space of Qs. Can I ask
a simple question related to this? I mean, you could start with almost all of your conjectures taking the ozonic strain on a manifold and wrapping a D25 brain around the manifold and letting it decay. So shouldn't you expect a family of Qs parameterized by a choice of closed ring conformal field theory? And if you're conjecturing that you get a non-perturbative definition of string theory out of this, shouldn't those cues really differ in a crucial way depending on which conformal field theory you started with?
Yeah. See, my feeling there is that the information about the closed string conformal field theory is in the star product. Although the star product is, in a trivial sense, doesn't look like dependent on closed string background, but to get sense of the star product, you really need to have a conformal field theory. And there you do need the closed string background.
shouldn't there be some field redefinition? If you take two conformal field theories, which you would say give you a different star product, shouldn't there be a field redefinition which actually turns the one star product back into the canonical star product?
See, if it's an open, in the two conformal field theories defined by open string background,
yeah,
then I think that should be a field redefinition. If they're defined by closed string background, I'm not sure.
As a principle, you kind of compute it, right? Because we, if the star product would be more practical, mm-hmm. thing. But if you just give you some kind of associative product, you can just compute mm-hmm. the possible definitions.
Yeah.
And just in terms of some cohomology theory.
Yeah, and it's hard to see how it will encode information about the closed string background. That it could deform the closed string background, right? I don't.
Well, this is kind of toy model, which is you just take these functions on the manifold and you look at deformation theory of that, so this mm-hmm. Hochschild cohomology computer, you get exactly, well, it's essentially kind of a topological string. You find that deformations are precisely given by what are essentially are the closed string fields. Kind of, for instance, like the B field is a good example. The B field can change the star product by making it non-commutative. And that's an example of the closed string field. So that's how you see closed string moduli appearing.
I see. Okay.
No, I don't quite understand. I mean, the closed string dependence of the star product must be something like an anomaly. I mean, as you say, formally it's independent.
Yeah.
But when you regulate it and you actually try to compute something, you're saying it's known that there's some residual dependence?
No, I don't think it's known. But okay. See, the point is,
isn't the B field a good example?
Yeah. So for
the just an automation to add B field becomes non-commutative.
Right. But they are inequivalent star products.
Yes.
Right. Yes. So
that's
not.
This isn't the same.
No, you can see
the overlap. The overlap of half strings is an incredibly formal construction.
Sure. No, I understand.
Actually, if you're trying to regulate that, if you try and write down a vertex that makes sense, you have to use the conformal filtering on the disk.
Yeah.
So it takes vertex operators on the boundary of the disk, and now the correlation functions and the three-string vertex depends on the closed string conformal filtering on the disk.
That's right, but you take a limit of that.
Yeah, so here is an example. So this is an example that the robot was saying. So the star product of non-commutative gauge theory is an example of the star product where you look at the massless spectrum. And depending on how you regularize it, as Zybert and Witten show that the product can be either commutative or non-commutative. And so that shows, so if you use a point splitting regularization on the worksheet, then you get naturally the so-called star product. Whereas if you use analytic regularization, you get commutative product of the open string field.
Well, if we're going to go further,
so,
back.
Yeah, I just.
Sorry.
So, therefore, the definition of the star product very much depends on how you regularize the product and what the closed string background is. Okay. Even for massless spectra. And so, now we imagine that it to be even so for full string field.
On that level, I mean, the space of open string fields depends on your choice of closed string background. So before we get to the point of multiplying them using the star product, the space of open string fields depended on the choice of closed string background as well. I don't know how to formulate that in a...
The same collection of string fields, you just redefine what the product is.
Wait, come on. It's not, if you're working in two closed string backgrounds which are deformations of each other, then I can produce an identification of the open string fields about one background and the open string fields about the other background.
Well, actually, there
let's choose two completely arbitrary closed string backgrounds, you're not going to be able to make such an identification.
But because science is stupid, right? But there is such an identification.
Yeah, absolutely. The spaces are isomorphic, but that's no...
If I remember, there was an attempt to write down closed string fields in open string language that Andy Strominger was involved in, among other things, and you ended up with open string fields that were, if I recall, non-associative. Did that all work out right?
There was an associativity anomaly,
right?
That we discussed.
Oh, okay. Was that you were also?
Yeah.
On that. Okay.
That's just because the sort of various sums when you expand everything in modes were not absolutely convergent.
Right, and that was for the open string fields representing changes that correspond to declarations of the closed string backgrounds.
Closed string backgrounds, yeah.
So.
Okay. That's right.
Is it clear that in any closed string background, the action would remain cubic?
Yeah, this, I mean, the yeah. Moving action is cubic.
Yes.
Any independent of the closed string background.
I don't think it's a contomorphic, like, it has to be contomorphic.
Since we've been waiting for 10 minutes, I think you to summarize, the upshot was that the information about the background was in the star product.
Yeah.
There's also information about the background, the closed string background in Q, right? I mean, depends on how you define your Fox space and how you define Q, right?
Yeah, okay, the Fox, that's it. No, the open string Fox space itself requires the closed string background, right? Otherwise, you don't know how to define
it. To the extent that your Q is universal, the information is all hidden in the star product.
Yeah. Well, in a sense, that, I mean, since our Q depends on the ghost, right? In some sense, the ghost Fox space is inverse. Okay, it doesn't really depend on the ghost. So that hasn't come yet. Okay, so this is the. Okay, so the third condition is that a new action should have classical solutions that represent the original D-brains and other D-brains. It is, of course, a natural requirement. Because this is what we require to implement conjectures 1 and 3. And finally, we want Q to be universal. And again, here it's not clear what exactly it means. It's operational, I'll say what it means. But the general idea here is that if you start with any D-brain in this theory, we should finally end up with the same, we end up at the same place. Because after the D-brain has disappeared, we have just closed string value. Right? So you soon have a memory of what D-brain you started with. So it's in that sense, the final action is still the size that you will get, should not know about what we really started. It's in that sense that Q should be universal. And the guess is that the way we implement this is simply by saying that Q is made purely of the ghost fields. So that it shouldn't know anything about the matter fields.
Ashok, I'm sorry, I don't want to belabor this point, but it seems to me that you're saying something a lot stronger here. Because you could imagine starting with a closed string background, and then any D-brain you put in that, you annihilate it, you get back that closed string background.
That's it.
And that would be universal in the sense you said.
Yeah.
But here you're saying something.
No,
stronger.
No,
you're saying it doesn't even depend on the closed string background.
No. See, Q, yeah, the point is, the, here, if Q had depended on the closed string background, it has to be in the open string Hilbert space.
It would have to be in the open string
Hilbert space. See, Q is operating in the open string Hilbert space, right? Okay. And what you're saying is that the Q shouldn't depend on, I mean, so Q should be an identity operator in the open string Hilbert space.
Hmm.
Okay, it's in that sense that it's universal.
It's a little hard to think about this since we don't have any explicit closed string, you know, objects around to build
yeah.
anything out of.
Okay, again, okay, so what I'm saying is here again, you should, I mean,
the net result is you are in fact constructing your Q independent of any closed string back
that's
as
it.
Well.
Yeah.
Which
but
I
the closed string information should be is I mean they are in the start product. Or even the open string Hilbert space that I construct. And that does depend on the closed string background. Because in that sense I don't think the dependence on the closed string background has disappeared by the means.
Isn't that sort of more of a regular? I don't know. I mean it seems to me that having the open string live in a particular Hilbert space associated with the closed string is a restriction that we do for sort of convenience to expand out in some basis. But isn't it natural in some sense to extend the definition of the open string field to sort of be bigger to allow it to sort of include all closed string backgrounds? At this
yeah, see the point is if you want to do actual computation, you have to do the Hilbert space, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so it's not clear how to, I mean, do any computation without choosing a Hilbert space. And once you do, through the Hilbert space, in a sense, you have information about the background. Right? That's all one can say at this stage.
It's like doing gates, you weave without the metric.
Very good.
Right.
So that's.
Gate tree is there.
Okay, so then the real question is that is it possible to find a Q which satisfies all of these conditions? And it turns out that it's reasonably easy to find a Q which satisfies the conditions A, B, and D. And let me remind you that the condition A is that of Gauge invariance, B means it should have trivial cohomology, and D is universality in the sense that it should depend on the ghost. And here I have written down one example. In fact, this was constructed by Gary and his collaborators long time ago. Okay, this turns out to satisfy these three properties. This the requirement. So these are arbitrary coefficients. But the non-trivial task is the condition C, okay, which means that you should be able to start with this background, with this field theory, and construct classical solutions that represent various events. And their ratio of gain sets, etc., should come out kindly. So how do you go about doing that? That's it. I'll take 5 more minutes to outline the procedure, and then I'll discuss the rest in the next lecture. But I should just note at this stage that although it looks like there are infinite number of possible choices of Q because ANs can be totally arbitrary, not all of them are unrelated. So many of them can actually be related by field definition.
Can we find a precise report which kind of A are we relating to each other and which other?
Well, we can certainly find, I mean, some field definitions which relate different A's. Okay. And we can identify 2 different classes which are not related by field definition. But beyond that, one doesn't know whether there are other field definitions which can relate. So for example, if you use these KN transformations, okay, the reparameterization which gives the midpoint fixed, that relates some of these A's. Okay, that doesn't change the start product. So here you can find precisely what kind of ANs are related by that transformation.
But this means that you're actually finding more than one possible BRSD operator?
Well, at this stage, I mean, we have one possible BRSD operator. Okay. And we don't. Okay, we may or may not have one possible more than one possible BRSD operator because there will be other consistency conditions. Okay. For example, if you, there is one condition which you might impose, which is that this operator analyzes the identity of the start product. That rules out a whole class of these. Okay, and most likely the S can all be related by field definition. Okay, if you impose that condition. Okay, whether you should impose that condition or not is not clear at this stage. Okay, but that's an additional condition you can use, and that has some nice features, okay, which you'll see later.
Sorry,
I can't
help that. How would you get away if you didn't annihilate
it? How
would you get away with it if you didn't annihilate the identity with Q? If you didn't annihilate the identity with Q, how would you get away with that? You just said maybe you don't need that.
Okay. Well, see, at least if you look at the formal constraints of gauge invariance, you don't need that. Okay, but clearly there is something funny about the Q's. Which is not inherent identity. We haven't been able to isolate a specific inconsistency in the theory if it doesn't inherit identity.
One of the relations that has to be satisfied is integral of q psi equals 0 for any qp psi, right?
No, see that's, we have changed that.
Well, you're watching that, okay.
Yeah, see, we need this condition.
Mm-hmm.
We need this. Okay, this is integration by parts.
Mm-hmm.
But this is slightly defined from saying that integral q psi equals 0. Yeah, this is enough for gain invariance.
Juanita, do you know if yours annihilates the identity operator?
Haven't tried.
But if it wouldn't annihilate the identity, then the action of Q on identity would be something that, being multiplied by any other psi, gives 0.
And the action of Q on something would be...
It would be but this is an algebra, it doesn't have elements which would...
Be zero by multiplying. Yeah, see the point is if this is a, if Q doesn't annihilate the identity, there is some kind of anomaly. Okay, does, you can formally give an argument that Q does annihilate identity. Because yeah. Q on I star I yeah. Okay, should be equal to Q on I, right? And you can just compare the two sides and you see that Q on I should be zero.
Q on I should times anything should be zero.
Yeah, because you can just show that Q on I should be zero because, see, you have this. Right? Q on I star I to believe this. And on this side you have 2 yes, Q yes. I and on this side you have Q I. Okay, so this clearly says that Q I should be 0. So unless there is some
whoops, you've got Q. Wait, what?
You have QI times I,
that just
says, plus I times QI,
so
you
might
want
to. It just tells you that QI is a state that has zero star product with anyone else, right?
Yeah.
which generally doesn't mean that it's zero.
No, see, the point is, if I has the start product of I with any state is the state itself,
right?
Then this says that ui is zero.
Okay.
Wow.
So, I
don't
understand. I think the operator is not a state.
Yeah, it is a state. I mean, see, any operator you can also think of it as a state in the.
It is not in the Hilbert space.
Yeah, it's not in the Hilbert space. Okay, so the question is whether we should impose these conditions on the fact that the I is kind of something is the same thing. Okay, whether we should also impose on the I itself. Okay. So if you look at the equation of motion here, which has this form. And now we can try to solve this by using a factorized answer. So this was first suggested by Wati. Because Q depends only on the ghost fields, we can look for a solution of the form where psi is a product of a ghost part and a matter part. Okay, and let's see what simplification occurs there. If you take an answer of this form, then the equation of motion that comes from here just splits into two parts. Okay, the ghost part says Q psi plus psi star psi equal to 0, and the matter part says psi equal to psi star psi. Now, you would probably recognize already at this stage that this situation looks very similar to what happens in non-commutative Bayes theories. Okay. Psi is a projection of what you under if we use the star as matrix one. Anyway, suppose we have a solution of this form. Then we can evaluate the classical action, the value of the classical action for a given classical solution. Because that's what will contain information about the tension of the brain. That also splits into two parts. One part which involves psi g q psi g, this is a ghost part, and then there's the matter part which is simply the weak inner product between psi m and psi m. Now, till we know q, we don't know what this object is. In fact, we don't even know what psi g is, because to find psi g, we need to know what q is. But we can clearly look for solutions of this equation without knowing what q is. So, in principle, given a solution, we can calculate this. Okay, so there is an unknown quantity which depends on the choice of Q, which you can call K, which you don't know. But then the rest we know. So we can in principle calculate. But this by itself doesn't help if there is an unknown constant sitting in front. But now we'll make another answers for the D-wave solutions. And according to these answers, we will assume that this ghost part, which solves Q psi j equal to psi d star psi j, is identical for different solutions representing different d-banks. Whether it is a d25 brain, d24 brain, d23 brain, or even multiple d-banks, okay, intersecting d-banks. Okay, for all such solutions, the ghost part is the same. The information about the solution is contained in psi m. In that case, if we now consider two different solutions, which say describe two different d-band configurations, which are candidates for two different d-band configurations, then we can calculate the ratio of their energy. Okay, simply as by taking the individual inner product of psi m itself and that of psi m prime itself. Okay. And given candidate solutions for a d-band, we can use this formula to calculate the ratio of the tensions of those d-bands. Okay. And we can try to verify if those ratios agree with what we know about the ratio of tensions of d-bands.
I wonder about the normalization of this psi m. You know, the total state was written as a tensor product of psi m and psi cos, and you can always divide psi cos by 5 and multiply psi m by 5. So
that's right.
Why does this normalization is physical?
Yeah, see, that doesn't affect us because that basically is a reflection of the fact that when you had split this equation in this form, right, you could have put a lambda here and a lambda in this. But we put the same lambda for all solutions. Okay, we take the same psi g for all different solutions. Okay, so that will just drop off. But there is certainly ambiguity on what you exactly call psi m in the normalization of psi m. Okay, so this is then what we will do next time. We will try to identify the solutions in the matter segment of the equation psi m equal to psi m star psi m. I will try to show that there are it is possible to construct solutions involving discussing various deep lengths. I'm going to calculate the ratio of the tension of those solutions. You get precisely what we know about the ratio of tensions of deep lengths.
Sorry, do you think there's something special about the D-brains that they have the same ghost part, or do you think it's going to be like just all solutions have sort of the same ghost part?
Well, in a sense, I would say that probably all classical solutions of open string field theory have D-brain description. Right? Because their tension will go as a 1 over G open square. Right? And this is a property of D-brains.
So you're saying the only classical solutions will be D-brains?
Yeah. Various configurations of D-brains, okay? Because, I mean, that's the tension problem. If you look at the formula for the tension of these solutions, you will always have 1 over g open square times some number. Okay? Because the g open square comes in front of the whole action. Okay? So, this will include, of course, multiple d-brains, intersecting d-brains, and so on. So, but I think all classical solutions can be thought of as some configuration of d-brains.
But those are static. I mean, presumably there's all sorts of dynamical.
Yeah, but for time-dependent solutions, of course, things are quite uncertain. What happens there? And there it need not even be the case that the solution is always factorized. If you start with factorized form as it evolves, it may lose its factorized property.
But cannot you kind of interpret this equation and formalism as an old covariant quantization of the superstring so that you forget completely about the host path and to deal with the open string field only with the matter part of it?
Yeah, in some sense it looks very similar to that, right? That the host part is completely factorized for the matter part, and you can probably address many of the questions just using the matter part. But where the host part will become important, I think, is when you try to do loop calculations, when you try to do quantum corrections. Then I think you cannot forget the host parts anymore. Okay, so in that sense, the host parts are necessary for consistency of the full string field theory. Okay, although for classical analysis, I think the matter part itself will be sufficient.
So for the classical analysis, it might be enough to take Psi-G to be completely universal for the dynamic configuration.
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah. So, if I understand correctly, what you're saying is that star multiplication with psi m is a projection operator, is that right?
That's it, yeah.
So you're saying the space of d-rays is the space of projection operators in the string field algebra.
That's right.
Subclass of projection operator protein, because there are many projection operators which are that's not correspond to the element of the Hilbert
well. Okay, so that's one question, which is, what do you say about the projection operators? What conditions do you put on them, and when do you consider them to be equivalent?
Yeah.
For example, if you had two such projection operators, you could put them, you could introduce some Champeyton spaces, put them on the diagonal, and start rotating things around with unitary matrices.
Yeah.
So it's not quite obvious.
So those will be equivalent. Okay, maybe I had another transparency error for the relation to it. Okay. This is a question of gauge equivalence, right?
About what?
Gauge equivalence. So you want to see what gauge transformation looks like in this language, in this factorized language. So maybe I'll show this last transparency anyway. So this was the general gauge transformation. Okay. Delta psi equal to 2 lambda plus psi star lambda minus lambda star psi. Now, if you take psi in this factorized form, then a general lambda clearly doesn't respect this factorized form. If you take a general gauge transformation parameter, you will not get delta psi in this form. Even if you take lambda to be of this form, it doesn't respect this form in general. Okay, if we apply q and psi star lambda minus lambda star psi. But suppose this lambda is such that the following identity is true. First of all, it's annihilated by q. And that lambda g star psi g and psi g star lambda g are both equal to psi g. Now, one candidate for this is if you did annihilate the identity operator, okay, then you could simply have chosen lambda g to be ig. Okay. That will satisfy all these conditions. Now, given a lambda g which satisfies this, so you can see that now we can rewrite this, take a lambda of this form. With lambda is satisfying this, it is easy to see that delta psi now has factorized form. And this means that you can rewrite this Gauss transformation purely in terms of psi m. Okay, delta psi m as psi m star lambda minus lambda m star psi m. And this is simply a rotation of the proliferation of light.
I'm sorry, actually I'm a little bit confused by the second equation in the green. I mean, that's no longer an infinitesimal gauge transformation. Lambda can't be taken to be arbitrarily small in some sense if you're going to say that lambda star psi is psi.
Well,
it's
implied, right?
Yeah,
it's
not implied
by small.
It's multiplied by small.
I'm missing the equation is lambda star psi g is equal to psi g, not epsilon psi g.
We get epsilon.
Yeah, it's kind of
But
you can let the psi g be order 1 and psi n be
order 1. Because the total gauge parameter is then small.
That's the problem.
The whole thing will have an epsilon intra.
Okay.
Lambda m can be small.
Now I have another question. That is, can you actually take lambda to be identity operator in the
Yeah, so that depends on whether it satisfies the associativity property, right?
Yeah, also, identity operator, I thought that even in Gauss except the identity operator does not belong to a Hilbert.
Yeah, so the question is, what kind of lambda you should allow in the string field? What kind of string field?
The string field is supposed to belong to a Hilbert space with normalizable inner product.
Yeah.
The Gauss transform lambda should also be an element of Hilbert space.
Sure. Yeah. See, quite often what happens is that when you take the inner product, including the matter and the Gauss sector, right, mm-hmm. things can become normalized, which may not look normalizable in the pure matter sector of the Gauss sector.
Okay.
Because, so one has to be careful, first of all, in defining what is the inner product. Because there is no natural inner product in the Gauss number 1 Hilbert, right? So it's not, so what kind of string fields are actual good fields, okay, that question is it. Really has to be settled.
Okay.
It's not clear at this stage what condition you should impose on string fields in order that they are good string fields. Mm-hmm. Anyway, with the most number one fields, there is no natural inner product between the two.
But for example, at least the operator, the state should be such that the action is well defined, etc.
Yeah, exactly.
Interaction.
You have to make sure that, for example, in order for the action to be gauged in the end, the star product with lambda has to be associated, right? Right. And you have to make sure that you are violating the associativity mandate. Mm. Because that is something that which has to be checked.
I see.
You're obviously getting very close to saying that the space of D-brains is the K-theory of the vertex operator algebra. That's true because K-theory, roughly speaking, space of projection operators of the algebra. But the hard part is twofold. First of all, to say what C-star algebra you're working with, and that's what you were just arguing with Hirose about. If, for example, you take the C-star algebra of bounded operators on Hilbert space, the K-theory is trivial, because you allow projection operators which have infinite rank. If you say it's a compact operator, it's Z, because you only allow finite rank. But the harder part is that you have to do stabilization, and you also have to define an equivalence relation of projection operators. And what you're doing here is conjugation by a unitary operator, but in fact, the math, for what it's worth, the mathematicians who do C-star algebra would have to do a fancier identification, roughly speaking, multiplying left and right by independent unitary operators. Actually, I think that the C-star algebra theory is going to be a limit of this thing. So I'm just saying that the question of when you identify these projection operators as physically the same is, I bet, is going to be tricky.
Yeah, in fact, that is necessary for example, studying marginal deformations, right? If you have two deviants which are on top of each other and two deviants which are separated,
yeah,
right? Both will be described by rank to projection of part,
right?
But they are not equivalent. Okay, yeah, that is something which should come out of. and then some general analysis.
Yeah. Well, this is a, this is an equivalence, but that there's going to be more serious equivalence. Thanks.